Select your program.
Dialogue.
Program initiated.
Approach the threshold. Engage rationality. Open your mind. Godspeed.
Bolting through the blackness of space to your listening devices, this is Flagship Freedom, the podcast that places you on the front line in the war of ideas. This is Michael.
And I'm Danny Boy.
And boy, do we have a program for you. Now, all right, this might be a little bit longer than you all are used to, but I hope that you will forgive us because we have an exceptionally exciting guest for everyone, somebody that has actually been requested a couple of times, and I have been looking forward to speaking to him for the longest time. Ever since I've heard of him, in fact, and this is Professor Walter Block of Loyola College. If you have heard of him, if you haven't heard of him, this is a must-listen-to episode that goes through a variety of industries and services that you, as our listener, wrote into us that should be in the public sector. And Professor Block has a very strong opinion as to why that should not be the case. So, Danny, what did you think about this episode?
Well, not only does he have an opinion, but it's incredibly well substantiated by facts and logic. But the guy's got absolutely razor sharp reasoning, logic, even for an anarcho-capitalist, which is really saying a lot. So I was highly impressed. Really delightful conversation. Covered a lot of topics. The guy's been thinking about this stuff for a lot longer than most people. So really worth a listen if you're one of those folks who likes the morality and the ethics, but you're not quite sold on the how, the specifics. This guy has got it on lock, so please listen. You won't regret it.
Yeah, this really is the episode for the pragmatic individual, the skeptical individual that thinks that politics is such a bore unless it actually shows some results. And all this philosophy and all this theory, you know, it's kind of rubbish unless the private sector really can do it better. Can it? Well, Professor Block says it can. So, without further ado, let's head right into the conversation.
All right, so Flagship Freedom audience, we are here with Professor Block, and he is an author, editor, and co-editor of many, many books. I'm sure that our audience is very familiar with his name, Defending the Undefendable, which is one of his masterpieces. If I do say so myself, I have it on my shelf over here. He's written on Murray Rothbard, Religion, Economics, and Social Thought, Economic Freedom Towards a Theory of Measurement. Our guest has written more than 500 articles for various journals, magazines, newspapers. He's a contributor to journals such as the Review of Austrian Economics, Journal of Libertarian Studies, et cetera, et cetera. He's been around the block, ladies and gentlemen. He is currently the professor and chair of economics, College of Business Administration at Loyola University. I would like to introduce the indispensable Professor Walter Block. Welcome to the cast.
You're very kind. Thanks for the lovely introduction.
You're very welcome. So before we get started, I have to say I have a very, very short personal anecdote. The last time I was in New Orleans, which is, by the way, my Shangri-La of cities, I absolutely adore the city. It's my favorite in the United States, possibly the rest of the world. I was touring Loyola's business school with one of my acquaintances. And at the very end, she's like, okay, we've got a dilemma right here. We can either go and meet with some of my professors for a little bit of a meet and greet at a coffee shop, or we can go and have some Cajun Creole. I'm like, anybody that knows me knows that I love my food, especially when it's southern cooking. But I asked, okay, is there a Professor Block going to be there? Because I have to meet him. I want to talk to him. And she said, unfortunately not, after reviewing her emails. So I said, all right, well, crawfish etouffee, here it goes. So finally, we get to talk. And I'm so thrilled, even though it is virtual. We are going to be talking about a variety of issues today. Of course, the audience knows that they have written in on anything from roads to courts to healthcare to education. And they were posing a lot of problems associated with the privatization of these industries or services. Some of these are provided by the government. Some of them are not. And some people have written in making cases as to why they should be in the public sector. And some people say, no, 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 we don't want the police in the private sector. That would be absolutely abysmal. So we'll be going through each one of these in turn. And the idea, of course, is to get sort of plant a seed for everyone to learn about this in a little bit more detail, not an extenuating circumstance. This is not a full episode on each one of these things. We will have episodes further on down the road concerning each one of these things. The good professor himself will be able to speak on a number of these issues. But we're going to keep each one of these rather short so that you can learn a little bit about each and then do the research on your own. And of course, we will be providing quite a bit of notes, as usual, on the YouTube page as well as our website. The first topic, which we actually provided. We provided the first roads, police, and military. We want to talk about the roads. Now, Professor, you've talked about this publicly as well as written about this in your privatization of roads and highways. I also have that on my shelf right here, a wonderful book, and we will link to it in the show notes. In fact, I think it is available online, at least the digital copy for free. So we recommend people looking at it. Often is the case, this is one of the most, even the most staunch libertarians think, okay, we got to provide roads. We got to provide domestic and international protection for our people. And perhaps courts will throw in that. Now, Professor, you've made a very strong case against the fact that roads should remain in the public sphere, as well as many other things. Would you like to elaborate a little bit more on your position?
Well, before I do, let me first just say two or three words about why we should privatize anything.
Yes, please do.
In general. And then we can apply it to the specifics, such as roads, which would be the first one we would do.
That would be wonderful.
There are two reasons. One is ethics or morality, and the other is economics. When something is done privately, there's no coercion. There's no coercion whatsoever. So you have that lovely T-shirt I see, and I offer you $10 for it. And if you agree, there's absolutely no coercion. So that's ethically good. On the other hand, if government is in charge of T-shirts, they tax people, and taxes are compulsory payments, and that's not as good. Mm. So one reason for privatization of anything is that it is more ethical, more compatible with the libertarian non-aggression principle. Okay, secondly, very briefly,
sure.
Is economics. People privately do things better privately than through government. One example that I'm fond of using is in the Soviet Union. What was it? 3% of the farms, the arable land, was private, and 97% was public. And on the 3%, they grew 25% of the crops. And on the 97%, they grew 75% of the crops, which indicates some disproportionality. And whenever there have been empirical studies of private and public working side by side or parallel, such as picking up garbage. The private can pick up a ton of garbage for one-fifth or one-quarter as much as it takes the public sector to do it. Why? Well, one reason is in the market, there's a weeding out process. If you don't do a good job, you go broke. And the remaining people are doing a pretty good job. Whereas in the government sector, if you don't do a good job, you don't go broke. They don't get rid of this public sanitation. They just throw more money at it.
Right.
Okay, so that's the general case for privatization of everything. Now let's talk about roads. My two main motivations for writing the book were, first and foremost, some 35,000 people a year die on the roads, which is not good. I mean,
not really.
Not good. Now, people say, well, it's not the government's fault. It's, speeding or drunken driving. Or vehicle malfunction. And they have a list of, 100 different things like that. My answer to that is no. Those are just the proximate causes. The ultimate cause is the manager who doesn't deal with drunken drivers and speeding and vehicle malfunction and driver inattention and all that. The example I use in the book is, look, suppose a restaurant goes broke. Are we going to say that the restaurant went broke because they didn't locate in the right place? They didn't have a good cook. They didn't keep the place clean. They didn't advertise. No. Mm. We'd say it was the manager who didn't do these things. So I ask, who is managing the road? Well, it's the government.
Yeah.
So the government is responsible for these deaths. My second reason, less important, but still very annoying, is the fact that we have roads that and cars and people that are capable of doing 75, 80 miles an hour on a highway safely. And yet during rush hour in some of our major cities, the fastest way to get around the city is on a bicycle or skates or something like that. Namely, we have rush hour. We have these horrendous, I used to live in New York, and we call the Long Island Express the longest parking lot in the world because it's 110 miles of just bumper to bumper cars. Yeah. Well, if we had private roads, what they would do is they would engage in peak load pricing. Namely, they would charge more during the morning or the afternoon rush hour and less at 3 a.m. And the traffic would flow smoothly, which would save a lot of aggravation and time and a lot of road rage, too. So those are my two major reasons for privatizing roads.
Yeah, I mean, it goes without saying that you go on a road nowadays and you just expect traffic as a standard of just existing, of driving. I mean, this is just an expectation. And what you're contending is something totally different, that the managers of the road could actually make these so efficient that we would be traveling from point A to point B. And if we experience traffic, it would actually be a major disappointment and even a surprise.
Right. I mean, if you have a supply and demand curve, what this is that the price is too low. Demand is greater than supply. Mm. Look, if you have medical care for free, you're going to have long queues for it, long lines for it. Well, this is a similar sort of a situation where you have free cars. I mean, we pay taxes through income taxes and through sales tax on gasoline and stuff like that. But you don't pay any more when you drive on the road at 3 a.m. or 3 a.m.
Yeah.
And yet at 3 a.m, there's no one there. And at 3 a.m. in major cities, there's a rush hour pretty much from 6 a.m. until 10 at night. There's just New York City and parts of California, Chicago, just heavy traffic all day long. There are too many cars on the road, and if we charged a little bit for it, we would reduce the use of it, and then we would automatically get people to carpool, people to use buses. Entrepreneurs would have an incentive to stagger work time so that not everybody goes from 9 to 5. Some people go 8 to 4, others 7 to 3, others 10 to 6, whatever. So in many, many ways, if we had a market, if we had free enterprise, we'd have less traffic. But again, I say traffic isn't the key. The key is deaths.
Yeah.
There's so many deaths. It's just horrible. So what could a private company do to reduce deaths? Well, I tell you, right now we have one set of rules of the road emanating from Washington, D.C. for all the roads. And on major highways, you have to do a minimum of 40 and a maximum of 70. And yet, if you do 75, there are people that will go right past you. So the actual speed is somewhere from, I don't know, 50 to 80 or something like mm-hmm. that. Maybe the problem is not speed. Maybe the problem is diversity of speed, namely the standard deviation or the variance in speed. Maybe, okay. You know, that some cars are going very fast and others are doing 55 and others are doing 85 or 75. And maybe, now, I don't know that this is true. All I have is a speculation that it might be true. And I tell you, if the three of us each had, you had one road, you had one road, and I had one road. And in my road, I said, everyone on the right-hand lane has to do 55. Everyone in the middle lane has to do 65. And everyone in the left lane has to do 75. And you had a different set of rules, you know, 50, 65, and 80, or whatever it was. And now we'd see where there were fewer deaths. And on my road, if you get caught drunk and driving, we pull your nose off or, you know, something serious.
That's pretty serious. Road,
you know, well, you know what I'm saying.
I know. That,
in other words, what I'm trying to do is set up competition. We know that competition works well. Right. Competition works well in those T-shirts or in this wristwatch that I'm wearing. Why shouldn't it work well here?
So, Professor,
Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask. Now, many people will say, you know, this all sounds wonderful, but theory be damned. Let's see some statistics. Let's see some facts. Are there examples, empirical examples of privatized roads, perhaps highways that exist now that seem to be working out more successfully than the monopolization of roads, let's say, in the United States? I know that in France, the majority of the roads are, at least the highways are privatized, or in Italy, there's a fair amount.
No, I don't think so. there are quasi private roads
right.
in Brazil, but they're under government control. They set up the rules of the road. There's no real privatization such as the t-shirts or wristwatches or lima beans or anything like that.
I see.
Fortunately, I can't give any empirical examples. All I can do is extrapolate from cases where there is private and public and say that the private works better than the public. Here, unfortunately, I can't. But the point is that right now we have a monopoly of roads run by the federal government. And even if 50 states could do different things, that would be better. But they don't even allow that. Like if, say, my state of Louisiana, if we wanted to have, say, a real bad penalty if you drive 50 miles an hour in the left lane, and some people do drive 50 miles an hour in the left lane, and now everybody has to go around them and have lane switching. Now, it just seems to me common sense that if you allow that, you know, you'll have more deaths than not. So on the Louisiana road, what they should do is say, look, if you let somebody pass you on the right, you're going to jail or, you know, something very serious, so that you don't have these people riding very slow in the left lane and then they have to go fast on the right lane. It should be the right lane is the slowest, the middle lane is in the middle, and the left lane is the fastest. So all I'm saying is we have to extrapolate from every other area of the economy where we know that competition is better than monopoly. Mm. I mean, we even have an antitrust division of the Justice Department dedicated to competition and not monopoly, and yet here we have monopoly.
Right.
So unfortunately, I can't say, well, look, over here in private road, they have many fewer deaths. I can say that some states do have a little bit of peak load pricing, although what they do is they have anti-peak load pricing. It's really horrible. Like the Washington Bridge or any of those major thoroughfares, what they'll do is they'll charge a fee to get across the Washington Bridge. But if you buy a monthly fee, it's actually cheaper per trip.
Hmm.
Got it. So what they're doing is encouraging more more bumper-to-bumper traffic. What they really should do is charge people who use the roads regularly at a certain time, but they don't do that. So unfortunately, I can't give you an example and say, look, here's private and it's better, so let's privatize, because I don't know of any examples of really privatization.
And just to clarify before we move on to the next topic, when you say that some of these countries really don't, they have quasi-privatized roads, you're saying that they're really on loan to private toll companies that are basically paying off the debt that the government has incurred by building them. And then, you know, once the debt's gone, then the government comes back in and manages it. Yes.
And the government sets the rules for the road.
Got it. So there's no competitive road. Right.
Namely, they'll pay $20 billion for the right to collect tolls on this road for the next 10 years.
Got it.
But the rules of the roads are set up by the government. So it's really not private. It's quasi, semi, demi private.
Right. Wonderful. Okay. Danny, do you have something to say before?
Yeah. I could just toss in real quick. One of the most common criticisms is people are worried that they're going to be having to toss quarters out their window every half mile, or there's going to be hundreds of companies charging and you're going to have 30 stickers on your car. Have you thought of any ways to potentially streamline paying for the roads? I know some people have ideas that maybe the local companies or billboards would do it so we don't have to worry. Maybe we could have a chip in the car. I think people are scared of leaving the status quo because it's so convenient, and any challenge to that is a red flag for them.
Yes, there is that phenomenon. When I first started writing about this in the 1970s, they were first starting this universal product code. Here is vitamin C pills, and you can see over here the universal product code. And I was doing research in grocery journals because they were just starting this, and people were saying, what are you doing with grocery journals? The idea is you put something like this on the underbody of a car, and now the car goes across some electronic mechanism, and at the end of the month, you get a bill for that. In Vancouver, there is a bridge, Patullo Bridge. I forget which bridge it is. And every time you go over that, you have to pay $5, but you don't have to stop and put a coin in into the bridge, which is a pain in the neck. You just do it electronically. You put your credit card in there and they deduct it from your credit card. They have the same thing in Seattle, to my knowledge. So you wouldn't have to put a coin in every 3 feet. That would be grotesque. And what they did, if you don't want, see, I have this view that not only should we have private roads now with technology, but people might say, well, if you're relying on technology, what about in the 1950s and 1940s when we didn't have this? Would you then have to put in a penny? No, because they had this thing in Singapore where what they do is think of a map of Singapore, and in the middle, like a bullseye, you know, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. And if you want to drive into the central city, which is very traffic congested, you have to have a blue tag, and the 9 is a red tag or whatever it is. You wouldn't have to have 30 different tags, but you would just have to have a certain color so that you could get in other words, if you had the red tag, which was the bullseye, you could go anywhere. If you had a blue tag, you could only go to the periphery of the main city. And if you had a green tag or whatever the color is, you could go a little further out. So we could do that. That's a very low tech thing. You know, you pay an annual fee and you now can ride in like during rush hour at 3 a.m. and go anywhere. So this thing could be done with low tech as well as high tech.
Right. And I even heard that that even perhaps merchants would come together as a coalition to fund this because it would be good for business. You know, there's a lot of incredibly colorful, fascinating, interesting ways to go about privatizing a number of things, as we will find very shortly. So moving on to the next topic, it is police. So basically, we're talking about domestic protection here. Many libertarians will say, and non-libertarians, of course, will say we need the police to exist. So Kevin writes in under government authority, Kevin writes, without any form of centralized law enforcement, our criminal enterprises and illegal businesses, business activities likely to gain power. Let's say business owner A has a competitor who starts doing well. Business owner B does not like this and decides to Molotov cocktail one of the business stores. Are fear and threat of force now more legitimate ways to conduct business in an anarchist, voluntarist society, a world without government?
Well, that's a very good question, a very challenging question, and a very important question, because if we can't solve that one, we have to be minarchists. Mm. We have to say, yes, there are certain legitimate functions of government, limited, but armies, courts, and police are usually the ones offered in this regard. But if we want to be anarcho-capitalists, as I am, then we have to deal with this question as well. Well, first of all, most police nowadays are private. They're not government police. There are more cops in malls and in shopping centers and things like that than there are official police. Mm. So maybe that'll put a crimp in the theory that somehow we need government police. We can't have private police. Okay. Secondly, what the public police do is half of the time, I'm just using half the time roughly, they're serving and protecting us. Namely, they're giving us tickets for going 1 mile an hour over the speed limit, and the speed limit's artificially too low. And they're hassling us about all sorts of victimless crimes. You know, you want to do prostitution, which is something that libertarians don't favor prostitution, but we favor the legalization of prostitution. And why should a cop stop consenting adults from doing that, or pornography or drugs or things like that? And then the public police promote the drug laws. Namely, they'll put you in jail for using marijuana or cocaine or buying it or selling it or what have you. And in a free society, the cops wouldn't do that. In a free society, what the cops would do would make sure there's no murder, there's no rape, there's no theft, there's no arson, there's no kidnapping, things like that, namely victim crimes. So if, let's say the public and the private police were equally able, a heroic assumption, but the public police, half the time or a big part of the time, they're stopping victimless crimes, which we don't want them to stop. We want them to leave people alone when they're not engaging in aggressive behavior against other people. We want them to stop this Molotov cocktail business. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that would be the second point. The third point would be that the private police, for the reasons that I gave in general when I introduced the entire subject, would be more efficient than the public police, because if the public police screw up, and screwing up is something endemic to all human beings, We all screw up. There's always going to be a bad cop, whether private or public. If you get a public one, they don't ever go out of business. When's the last time you ever heard of the, I don't know, the Cleveland Police Department went bankrupt and they had to substitute another police department? Never. Yeah. That's when. Whereas if the Acme Police Service screws up, people say, well, I'm not going to go to Acme anymore. I'm going to go to the Jones Police Force. So you have this weeding out process of inefficiency. And let's say the Jones Police Force provides the same service, but cheaper than the other. They use electronics or whatever it is that they do. They would have an incentive to do it because they would be competing with other police companies for customers. Now, here is the granddaddy question. Suppose you had two police forces, the Acme and the Jones, and the Acme is covering Merchant A, and the Jones is covering Merchant B. Remember, you said that Merchant A is going to throw a Molotov cocktail at Merchant B because it doesn't like that Merchant B is taking his customers away. And now what happens, and here is Ayn Rand, who criticized the laissez-faire capitalism application for police. She said, well, now what happens if you have two police forces or police companies fighting each other? That's not cool. That's not good. And the answer, and what she said was a blank out, that we libertarians have no answer to that. Well, not true. We do have an answer to that. And the answer to that is, and this applies for courts as well as police, suppose you had two police forces that had customers who subscribed to their services, and the customers were having a fight. And the police company A is protecting Merchant A, and police company B is protecting Merchant B. Now what? You don't want them to be fighting. Well, the answer coming forth from Murray Rothbard and also David Friedman, who's done yeoman work on this, is as follows. There are two kinds of police forces. Call one the legitimate forces and the other the illegitimate forces. The legitimate police forces will have anticipated this. They know that at some time they might come to a different conclusion about the guilt or innocence of merchants. And what they will do is they will have a contract with each other. If ever they seem to be on opposite sides of something, they will write back to the home base, or they'll go to police court three, or they'll go to a court or some other group who will decide which one of them should prevail. So without any fighting. On the other hand, if you have what are called bandit police forces, really gangs like the Blood or the Crips or the Mafia or illegitimate groups, well, they will fight everyone. They'll fight other illegitimate ones and they'll fight legitimate ones. But the point is that fighting is expensive. The legitimate ones will only have to fight the illegitimate ones. The illegitimate ones will have to fight everyone. They'll have to fight other illegitimate ones plus all the legitimate ones. So they will be weeded out through this market process. We will have less and less of that. Will we have perfection in laissez-faire, in free enterprise, in anarcho-capitalism? No, we will not have perfection. There will always be some mistakes made by private companies. And when they make mistakes, they'll pay for it. But the point, you know, an economist was once asked, how is your wife? And the answer was, compare to what? Well, we're now talking about private police. Compare to what? Compare to public police? Very good. Compare to perfection? Back to the Garden of Eden? No, not that good. In the Garden of Eden, you don't even need police. And if you had them, they would work perfectly. But in the real world, we have a wealth of evidence and logic to show that the private police would be better able to take care of the protection of people, legitimate protection of victim crimes, not victimless crimes.
Right. And you made a very good point at the very beginning of the discussion, saying that we have more private than public here. And I also like to incorporate this wonderful little story, this gentleman named Dale Brown. He was a former police officer. He now lives in Detroit, our hometown, running the Threat Management Center. This gentleman, his philosophy is that he thinks that a community-based policing can prevent potentially violent environments through nonviolent creative methods. He recruits nonviolent, intelligent people that aren't prone to violence or aggression, don't have criminal records, so on and so forth. He trains them to de-escalate and discourage potential criminals. He runs security for 500 businesses, 1,000 private homes in Detroit, and provides services to families that can't afford it. He's never had a court date once, never had anyone injured or killed in 20 years, and anyone under his protection has never been injured. That is remarkable. And I would love to have him on the show to talk about this further. But this is just an example of many other of these sorts of private security firms that are popping up that are doing as better, if not more, of a better job than the police. And they're working in coordination, in conjunction with the law. Think of what they would be able to do without the handicaps that they would have. I mean, it's remarkable to listen to Mr. Brown's story as well as others.
Absolutely. You have the same thing in the French Quarter in New Orleans, where there was a lot of crime and the public police was there and they weren't able to stop it. And what you had is a bunch of merchants hired private police and they put cameras up here and there. And, and then there was this group in the Bronx or New York City where they would all wear little red hats. I forget the name of them, mostly black and Puerto Rican young men who were served in this quasi police role. So you have examples of private police and every shopping mall, every time you go to a big food fair or something like that, there's a private cop. You go to a bank and there's some private cop there. And as I said, there are more private cops now than public cops. So the idea that somehow only public cops can be cops, they're the real police, is fallacious.
Danny, do you have anything to add, or are we going to be moving on to the next topic?
No, I think that was great.
Yeah, I think so as well. So the next topic we'll be talking about, two individuals wrote in. Antone writes, I think most domestic issues are philosophically dealt with. I believe he is talking about through anarcho-capitalism, but large-scale global conflict is something I have not seen directly addressed. And Derek also writes, who would represent people's interests to other nation states? Wouldn't it be hard to represent all individuals' interests with one voted individual going to negotiate on behalf of a whole entire city? So he's talking about ambassadors or representatives of the people. There's a lot to chew on here, and there's been a lot that has been written about this. And this is something that I really don't have at all worked out in my head. And I'm hoping that you'll be able to elucidate us a little bit further, Professor.
I'll do my best.
All right.
There is literature. One of the guys is Rummel.
Rummel. Okay.
And another guy is Courtois, C-O-U-R-T-O-I-S, a French guy. And there's a third guy, who, and all of these guys have done research as to how many people have died due to government.
Mm.
And I'm not talking about wars. I'm just talking about governments killing their own people. And the number is something like 180 million in the last century. Governments have killed their citizens. And then you get government wars, which is, you know, many, many more people have been killed by governments. So if you want to have worldwide peace, what you don't want is governments. You want to de-escalate this as much as possible. You don't want to have the present system, which is a very bad system. What you really don't want is world government. If we had world, I'm Jewish. And my people have always been running from a dictator. We go from here to there, get kicked out of here, we go there, we get kicked out of here, we go there. Imagine if there was a world government. Then there'd be no place to go. Mars and Venus are not yet able to support human life. Mm. So what we don't want – so one question is, what's the optimal number of governments if we have to have them? And paradoxically, more the better. If we had, 2,000 governments, each the size of Monaco or the size of Singapore, we'd be much better off that way than if we had three governments like they had in 1984, the novel, Oceania, whatever, the three different groups. Or if we had one world government, that would even be worse. So ideally, the anarcho-capitalist view is we should have 7 billion governments, one for each. And if you want to date a girl, you have to ask your foreign minister to go to her foreign minister and arrange the date. I'm kidding about that. So you get a little bit of a paradox here. If we had city-states, you know, like Luxembourg or Monaco or places like that, or, you know, the problem with Italy and Germany is up until about the 1870s, that's what they had.
Right.
Italy had, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 little principalities and city states and whatever. And then they amalgamated into Italy and Germany. And that was improper. It was the wrong way. I support decentralization and secession in all cases. Like Quebec wants to secede from Canada. Great. Montreal wants to secede from Quebec. Great. A certain neighborhood in Montreal wants to secede from Montreal. Great. Similarly, with the secession of, I don't know, two or three places in Spain and in Italy want to secede. California wants to secede. Texas, God bless them. Let them go. Let them have their own country. So I think that if we wanted to have more world peace, what we would have would be secession. I mean, where are the trouble spots? A lot of the trouble spots are in Africa and in the Middle East. And a lot of the reasons for the trouble spots is that French and English people made up the countries in Africa, and they didn't make it in accordance with the tribes. You know, they made it in accordance with their own desires for oil or whatever it was. So you'd have one country with three different tribal groups, each of which hated each other. Mm. The Hutus and the who are the other guys? The
Tutsis.
Tutsis, they hate each other, and yet they're in the same place. If you had Tutsi land and Hutu land, it would be better. Similarly with the Kurds. There are Kurds in Turkey. There are Kurds in Syria. There are Kurds here. Why not have Kurdistan? I mean, if I were making up the countries with the goal of reducing tensions, I would have a Kurdistan, so you wouldn't have these gigantic problems. Another way to look at this is the U.S. is trying to become a world government. The U.S. has, what is it, about 1,000 military bases in about 165 countries, and there are only 220 countries, and we've got military bases in most of them. Mm-hmm. And wherever the U.S. goes, we have problems. One of the good things about Donald Trump is he said, look, Hillary and her boys went into Libya and knocked off Gaddafi, right. And now look what we got. We got ISIS, which is worse. They did the same thing with Iraq. Now they're trying to do the same thing with Syria. Now, the strong men of Iraq and Syria and Libya, they're not good guys. But again, the economist was asked, how is your wife? And he said, compared to what? I'd rather have Gaddafi in Libya, and I'd rather have Saddam in Iraq, and Assad in Syria. They're trying to bump off Assad now,
right?
Because I mean, these were local military strongmen. Not that I favor them; they were not the Murray Rothbardians, you know. But at least they kept the peace in a very brutal way. Whereas now, what you have is these more refugees than you've ever had since World War II, I think it is. And it's all due to the U.S. depredations of running around the world trying to run things for everyone. I'm a big fan of John Quincy Adams and George Washington, who said, no entangling alliances. We don't go abroad looking for dragons to slay.
Right.
I'm a Ron Paulian here. The purpose of the U.S. military should be to protect the U.S., and that's it. I'm sort of a Coast Guard fan. The Coast Guard stays close to the country, and anyone trying to take us over, the Coast Guard will be our first line of defense. So I'm not sure that I've answered the question fully, but at least I babbled about the question for a while. And if you had to take anything away, it would be U.S. imperialism, U.S. militarism is one of the greatest dangers for world peace. And the less the U.S. intervenes everywhere, the better. And Donald Trump, I mean, he says he can get along with Putin. Hillary called him a Hitler. That's not a good sign. So I think for world peace, the U.S. should stick to its knitting. It shouldn't have soldiers all over the place. Donald Trump said, what are our soldiers doing in Germany? What are they doing in Japan? What are they doing in Korea? Let them solve their own problems. The U.S. trying to solve everyone's problems is not a recipe for success.
Yeah, so a lot of what you say certainly makes sense, but I can anticipate some individuals that are listening right now thinking, okay, well, we live in a nuclear age where at the press of a button, a nuke goes over to another city and completely obliterates it. It's not like two fronts of soldiers are fighting there and back and we have a battle and then we can negotiate afterwards. One false move, and of course, you know, everyone's toast. Now, we might have a number of good state actors, a number of, let's say we have 7 billion people that exist in the world, or are their own states. Now, are we to equip every single city state with a nuclear firearm? And does that mean that we need a robust NSA or a city state that has capabilities of spying on this and that so we can avoid that? Because if somebody has nukes at their fingertips, even terrorists and whatnot, we need to be able to be all over the world at once. And how is that possible in an anarchist society?
Well, notice that the way we, well, so far we haven't had any nuclear exchanges, thank God.
Yes.
In spite of government's best efforts in that direction. Murray Rothbard would say that nuclear weapons are per se incompatible with libertarianism, whereas a gun, here I have a gun, and I can shoot one bad guy. Namely, I can focus it on bad guys. So it's a legitimate weapon, or at least it's not per se an illegitimate weapon. Per se, an illegitimate weapon is one that can't be confined to bad guys, but just gets everyone.
A lot of collateral damage.
A lot of collateral damage, precisely. Right. So in a laissez-faire anarcho-capitalist society, there'd be no nuclear weapons. Mm. One of my articles, I said, well, if we lived on Jupiter and we only had 10,000 people on Jupiter, then it would be okay to have a nuclear weapon as long as you kept it in the middle of your million acres, because if it exploded, it would stay within your acreage. But apart from that, nuclear weapons are per se invasive, aggressive weapons. They violate the non-aggression principle per se. But, you know, we have them. Now what are we going to do? Well, let's hope and pray that we never have. Well, there is one country that detonated 2 of them. I forgot about that. And it's a country that we all live in.
Right.
Hiroshima, Nagasaki. The U.S. has the, horror of detonating these horrible weapons. So this is just yet one more point for reducing U.S. militarism, because the U.S. is the only country that ever did that. So far, ISIS, even ISIS hasn't done that. But the U.S. has incinerated thousands, hundreds of thousands of people with nuclear weapons, well, atomic weapons, but roughly the same thing. So I don't think that there's any, quick fix. Like if we implement laissez-faire capitalism, we'll be safe from the nuclear threat. I don't think we can go that far. And if people are criticizing laissez-faire capitalism and anarcho-capitalism for this, I would say, don't criticize us. We didn't do it. We didn't have a society that that had this nuclear threat. It was them, the governmentalists, the statists that did this. So, I would say the answer to the critic who would say, well, you know, how is laissez-faire capitalism, anarcho-capitalism going to solve this? We can't. No one can. There's always that threat. But it was them, that system that started this. It wasn't our system that did this. If we had our system, presumably we'd have world peace and you wouldn't have that problem, or you might not have the problem. It's hard to do contrary to fact history. You know, suppose Hitler had won the war and now what would life be like? It's just very speculative. Suppose Ron Paul was the president in 1776, and then it was Murray Rothbard, and then it was Hans Hoppe, and you had people like that who were in charge. What would life be like? I tend to think that we'd have much more safety than we now have.
Got it. Danny?
If there's one thing I could just add about U.S. interventionism, one problem a lot of people have is, well, how would we be charitable to people who are being ruled the world over? You know, aren't we, at least in some instances, the U.S. has had a positive effect and some good intentions. And one thing I don't want people to get confused about is the fact that you can still help people. When you describe what you believe the U.S. military should or shouldn't do, you're talking about the current situation and the fact that we live under a monopoly where any private charitable solution has been crowded out. So it's not like we're saying you should never use force to defend other people. It's just that, you know, using the blunt tool, the ham-handed government, is not a good approach. It's not that we're saying you can never use force to go fight people and free people who legitimately need help.
Very, very good point. I think that's an excellent point. We libertarians are not pacifists. Some of us might be, but we need not be pacifists. If I see you, Mike, hitting Dan, and I'm bigger and stronger than both of you, I can stop Mike from hitting Dan, or vice versa, whatever. We can engage not only in self-defense, but in other defense. However, let's get back to minarchism for a bit. The function of the U.S. military is to just defend U.S. people in the U.S., not an American who goes to Finland, and because then you have incompatible sovereignties. Like if the U.S. says, well, if you go to Finland and the Finland people don't treat you right, then we'll kick the Finland butt. No, no, no. When you go to Finland, and I'm just picking Finland as a peaceable country, you're on your own. You're in a different sovereignty. So the function of the Finnish military should be to protect Finns in Finland. And when they come to the U.S., it's up to the U.S. government. Namely, you take your chances. Now, there was this case in the Spanish Civil War where the Lincoln Brigade went over to fight in favor of the commies against the fascists in 1936 in Spain. But it wasn't the U.S. military, thank God. Right now, the U.S. military is involved in the civil war in Syria. That would be improper. The point is that if you want to go over and help the Hutus or the Tutsis or whichever group was being slaughtered by the other group, you and on your own can go there as a private citizen. We have, as the Lincoln Brigade did go over to Spain to help the commies against the fascists. But the U.S. military should stay put. It should only defend the U.S. in the U.S. And if we all follow that, we'd have much more peace. But I think Dan is making an excellent point that no one is saying you shouldn't have other defense or helping other people, but it should be done privately, not through the U.S. military. The U.S. military shouldn't be in South Korea helping the South Koreans ward off the North Koreans or whatever it is. Let the South Koreans take care of themselves. The U.S. shouldn't be involved talking now about something very relevant in Taiwan. Vis-a-vis China. Donald Trump just accepted congratulations from the president of Taiwan.
Right.
And everyone said, oh, you can't do that because, you know, China won't like that. Well, George Washington, John Quincy Adams, and those guys were saying, we seek peace and friendship with every country. This is the Ron Paul view. So I think there was nothing wrong with Donald Trump speaking, whether he initiated the call or he received the call from the Taiwanese. And I think it's perfectly all right to sell them military weapons because I'm in favor of free trade and I'm not in favor of gun control. But to tell the Taiwanese that we are going to protect them against China, no, it's up to them. The U.S. should only protect itself. And if people are afraid that China will invade Taiwan, let them go over there to Taiwan and help the Taiwanese on their own.
Very good. Well, there are so many other threads to pull on this conversation. This particular one is a doozy, and it might necessitate some further episodes. But for now, like we said, breadth, not too much depth. Hopefully you got a little bit of both there. So the next topic is the court system, our judicial system. Kevin writes, in the absence of a court system, who, if any, dictates detainment and punishment of violent offenders, i.e. serial killers, rapists, etc.? I suppose the free market could insist on a decision. However, could this incite a more mob mentality approach?
The court analysis, very similar to the police analysis that we did. Now, look, Mike and Dan are now going to have a fight. You disagree as to something. One of you sold 100 cows to the other guy, and the other guy says, well, I got 90 cows, and 10 of them were sick. And the other one says, no, you got 100, and they were all healthy.
Oh, Danny.
And now we have a dispute. Danny, you shouldn't have sent those cows.
Yeah, you swindler.
So, Mike, you go to your brother, who is your court. And you invite Dan to come to your brother's court. And you say, my brother, he'll settle this. And Dan says, what, your brother? He's a little biased in your favor. Let's go to my mother. And Dan's mother's court is Dan invites Mike to Dan's mother's court and says, you know, my ma, Dan is a fair court. She's a fair judge. But let's go there. Okay. So now we have now we have four options. One, you both agree to go to Mike's brother's court. And when you agree to go to a court, you sign something and you give a fee and you agree to abide by the decision of the court. And you both go to the court, you both go to Mike's court, and Mike decides whatever he decides, that's it. Solution. Or you both agree to go to Dan's mother's court. And again, whatever Ma Dan says, that's definitive, and you both agree. Now, the third possibility is that Mike's brother will agree with Dan, or Dan's mother will agree with Mike, and we have a conflict. But let's forget about that. Let's take the case where Mike's brother agrees with Mike, and Dan's mother agrees with Dan, and each of you go to your own court. You refuse to go to the other guy's court. Now, again, we have the similar analysis that we did with the police. There are two kinds of courts, legitimate courts and illegitimate courts. Legitimate courts, let's say that Mike's brother and Dan's mother are both legitimate courts. They will have anticipated this. They will have had a contract with each other saying, look, if ever we come out on opposite sides of a decision, we're going to go to Walter. And that'll be it. And they swore an oath and they made a contract with each other and they said they would come to me. Or they picked 15 judges and they said, we'll do a random number to pick which judge will decide in any given case. Mm-hmm. And they are obligated to listen to whatever I say. And I'm the Supreme Court in this case. And next case, it might be me versus Mike and Dan will be the judge. So it's not that I'm the judge. I'm just the judge in this case. Okay, so that's the legitimate court. The illegitimate court, again, will not sign any such thing, and they'll say my way or the highway. And they will have to, usually courts will be armed with soldiers or police, and they'll have to fight everyone, other illegitimate courts plus legitimate courts, whereas the legitimate courts will only have to fight the banded courts, so we can sort of say that the banded courts will depart. Now, I want to buttress this with the following analogy. They say that the pen is mightier than the sword. Well, here's a pen. How big is the pen? I don't know, 5 inches, 6 inches. How big is a sword? Well, a sword is, I don't know, 3 feet, 4 feet long. So you think that if there's a duel between the pen and the sword will win. No, the pen will win. Why will the pen win? Because the pen determines in which direction the sword is pointed. And by the pen, I mean legitimacy. The reason people pay taxes now is they think that the U.S. government is legitimate. If they didn't think the U.S. government was legitimate and 90% of them didn't, the IRS couldn't get 90% of the people to pay taxes. The IRS couldn't tell the police to go and get those 90% because the 90%, the soldiers would be the children and the brothers and the sisters of the 90%. So this is why intellectuals are very important, intellectuals being the pen. This is why the government is always suborning the intellectuals to say, yes, the state is necessary. The state is wonderful. Okay, it's imperfect, but at least, you know, we have to have the state because otherwise we'd have anarchy, and anarchy means bomb throwing. Well, you know who's throwing bombs. It's not anarchists. Very, very few anarchists are throwing bombs. So the analysis would be the same thing, namely that the legitimate courts would have legitimacy. Look, in the Godfather movie, what happened was the baker's daughter was raped. You people see the Godfather movie?
Oh, yeah, of course. One of my favorites. Okay,
the baker's daughter was raped, and the baker came to the Godfather and said, that guy raped her, kill him. And the Godfather said, well, you know, he only raped her, he didn't kill her. We are going to give him such a beating that he'll never forget the beating, which will be roughly proportionate justice. Okay, you might argue whether it was exactly just, but the point is that he had some sort of legitimacy. That's why the mafia did so well, is because they had some sort of legitimacy. They were seen, they were fair, and they were seen to be fair. Mm. Namely, again, it was an approximate case. I think a murder, or rather the death penalty for a rape would be too severe, whereas a very severe beating would be roughly like a rape, give or take. Now, I don't want to get involved in sexism and stuff like that, but the point is that the reason that the mafia lasted so long is they had legitimacy. Now, and a lot of the things they did were they provided services that were prohibited by sex and drugs and prostitution and pornography and stuff like that. The last thing that the mafia wants is legalization of all these things, because then if it was legal, they wouldn't have a an inner track in providing these services. So my answer, to summarize my answer, is very similar to what I said about the police. There would be private courts. And by the way, the American Arbitration Association is a private court. I have a buddy who is a professor of engineering, chemical engineering at Stanford. And companies, when they make a contract having to deal with chemical engineering, what they say is, in case we have a dispute, we'll go to this guy and whatever he says, we'll abide by, and we'll sign a contract to that effect. And the reason they do that is because he has legitimacy. Namely, in the past, even if you lost your decision, he gave a ruling that even you, the loser, had to say, well, you know, he's got a point. I didn't win, but what the heck? I felt justice was being done, even though I lost. So we do have private courts. The rabbis have private courts. The churches have private courts. There are private courts all over the place. I don't know that there are more private judges than government judges, as I do with police. But there are arbitration societies, arbitration associations, MasterCard. I buy that shirt, Mike's T-shirt that I've been admiring this whole hour, and I buy it with a credit card, and now we have a little dispute. Well, MasterCard will settle that. And a friend of mine, a former student of mine, Ed Stringham, wrote a book about how it is that all these private institutions come about, where when you give your credit card number, it's pretty safe. You buy a book on Amazon. The book usually comes, and if it doesn't come, Amazon will make good on it. Well, Amazon is acting like a court, right, when they make good on your book sale. And if you complain that the XYZ book company didn't give you the book and they inspect, they won't allow XYZ to deal with Amazon anymore. So XYZ has an incentive to send you the book after you send them the money. So we have all sorts of private it's sort of like the fish in the sea. The fish are not aware of the sea. We're not aware of the air. We don't appreciate the degree to which private companies and private police are keeping us safe and giving us justice. We have to delve a little bit beneath the surface to see that this really does occur, and that the government is not the only provider of these things. And like in this case of the chemical engineer, the average government judge doesn't know from chemical engineering. In order to be a good judge of chemical engineering, you have to know something about chemical engineering. And the guy who becomes a judge is maybe a politician or somebody who got voted in. It's a very different way. In many countries, like in Canada or Great Britain, the judges are people who were appointed judges because they gave up their seat to the prime minister or something like that. Namely, they don't really know anything about the law, but they're appointed judges. Whereas in the private sector, you're not going to be appointed a judge of a technical area unless you know something about that area, which is pretty important.
Right.
You know, you brought up a really fantastic point about legitimacy. And people always ask, well, what if a company just gets a ton of money and they hire a bunch of soldiers and they go around policing people? And oddly enough, it starts sounding like a government, right? They start demanding money for their services, et cetera. But you said legitimacy. People would clearly see that as illegitimate. And the last thing we want to do is establish a monopoly at the center of society that is doing wrong. So if we equip people with the ability to see evil for what it is, well, of course, they're not going to put up with it. You're going to resist McDonald's when they come and try to force you to buy a quarter pounder. So I just want to hammer that home for our listeners, is that once people realize that taxation is theft and extortion, they're not going to put up with it. And no company could ever hope to survive on aggression. It's simply not feasible. Like, you can't prove.
I want to be more moderate. I don't want to say no company could ever do it. That, I think, is too extreme, and I'm a moderate. I would say that it's possible that sometimes it happens, but very rarely. And compared to the alternative, we've got that right now. In other words, it could happen in rare cases, and then the market would overcome it. So I think it's too sharpish to say it would never occur. It might occur, and then it'll be swallowed up. I think that's a friendly amendment to what you said, but I certainly agree with what you said.
Accepted.
Such a lousy extremist.
Yeah, we got to take away your radical credentials right here. Okay, so we're on to our next topic right here. Aaron writes concerning immigration, which is a very big topic for libertarians right now, very big topic for everyone right now. You have libertarians on one side and the other side, and some of the greatest architects of anarcho-capitalist thought, libertarian thought, some have sat on one side of the fence and some on the other. I was recently reading an article that was written by Murray Rothbard, and Rothbard in the article is called Nations by Consent. He brings up several examples of governments essentially settling their own people within different countries of the Eastern Bloc. This is during Stalin's rule, to pacify them, to essentially to outbreed them or to make it much more difficult for dissidents to overthrow the Stalinist rule. Now, Hoppe kind of hammers this home a little bit further on the anti-immigration side, or at least immigration control side, I should say. He makes a differentiation between goods that have been invited, goods being inanimate objects, and immigrants who can enter without invite. They have legs, they have wheels, they can move in. Goods cannot do that. They have to be invited in they have to be brought in by people. So since we live in a country, he says that as a government, the government should act as a trustee or representative of the individual in the nation's best interest. Essentially, what he concludes is that forced exclusion is bad, but forced immigration is also bad. So, Professor, what do you say to something like this? This is a very complicated issue, and I get into quarrels all the time about it. I haven't made up my mind quite honestly, but I do understand in a free society, we would have completely private land. So people would be able to demonstrate their preferences by saying, okay, well, I don't want you to move into my land. You may be able to cross through the land, but I don't want you moving it. I don't want to do business with you, that sort of thing. But in a land that is publicly owned, quote unquote, as illegitimate as it might be, where we have public land, nobody knows whose is whose, what should the government do? What should we push for as libertarians, anarcho-capitalists?
Well, this is a very important issue.
It is.
I would say the two issues on which not only libertarians disagree, but the general public disagrees. One is immigration. The other is abortion. Mm. Like on abortion, you have two highly credentialed libertarians that have the opposite point of view. Murray Rothbard is pro-choice. Ron Paul is pro-life. You can't get two more heavily credentialed libertarians than those two, and yet they're 180 degrees opposite. Right. So that's one issue. Another issue is immigration. And here you have Murray Rothbard, who at one time was an open borders guy, and toward the end of his life, took a 180-degree change. And Hans Hoppe, who I also revere as a libertarian theoretician, are anti-open borders. I'm an open borders person myself. And there are other very highly credentialed libertarians, Ben Powell, for example, Anthony Gregory, who I've written with on this, are also open borders people. So you have a very sharp, stark difference. I have a solution.
All right.
And the solution is open borders coupled with private property. See, the way I look at it, I have these glasses, and these are libertarian glasses, and the way I look at all problems through these libertarian glasses is the non-aggression principle. So I say, is prostitution between consenting adults a violation of libertarianism? Well, is there any initiation of violence? No. So it's legitimate. Is rape okay for libertarians? No, because there is invasion. There is a violation of the non-aggression principle. So now I ask the following. I say, look, here comes a Martian or an African or an Indian or a Bangladeshi or somebody.
Right.
And what he does is he takes a helicopter, or he's a good pole vaulter, and he lands in the middle of Alaska or in the middle of Wyoming in the Rocky Mountains that has never been touched by human hands or feet, virgin territory. And what he does is he starts plowing and cutting down a tree and, homesteading the land. Did he violate the non-aggression principle? No, he didn't. Therefore, anyone who stops him, any border control guard, whatever, who says, hey, we're kicking your butt out of here, he's the violator. So I've now established, at least in one case, where you have this peaceable immigrant who is an illegal immigrant. He didn't go through any buy or leave by anybody. And he just starts homesteading. Did he violate the non-aggression principle? No. Therefore, the case for open borders. Now, Hans Hoppe makes a very important point. He says, look, if you export that T-shirt, I don't know why I'm picking on your T-shirt, but it's a great T-shirt.
Thank you.
If you export your T-shirt, there have to be two people that agree, namely you, the exporter, and me, the importer. I'm in Venezuela, and I'm importing a T-shirt. Two people have to agree. Or there's an investment. An Australian invests in Finland. Well, again, you have to have two people agreeing. The Australian has to buy a factory. The Finnish people have to sell a factory. Fine.
Right.
Then what Hans says is, but in immigration, there's no two people agreeing. One guy just goes somewhere else without any buy or leave. And I say, well, so what? Too bad. Because I've proven this guy in the middle of Alaska or in the middle of Wyoming in the Rocky Mountains, he came with any buy or leave. So buy or leave or permission or agreement is not necessary for libertarianism. You can initiate things on virgin territory. Now, it's true that the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, claims all that land. But we libertarians don't have to take that seriously because we libertarians are Lockean, Rothbardian, Hoppeans who believe that the only way to get legitimate property is to, you know, mix your labor, your hands or your feet with the property, cut down a tree, whatever, put in a crop, whatever. Okay. Now, the next problem is, but look, suppose we have open immigration. It's not going to be one guy from Mars or Africa or wherever. It's going to be a billion Chinese are going to come. And they're going to come in the middle of Alaska or in the middle of Wyoming, a billion of them, and they're going to ruin everything. I mean, well, maybe not ruin. They might be nice guys, but they're going to change our culture, and we don't want that.
Mm.
So I have a solution for that. Privatize every square inch of the property, and then if they come, they're trespassers. But as long as there's empty land or public land, which is another issue, they can come. Now, Milton Friedman once said, he said, look, you can't have welfare and immigration because our welfare standards are so good that people come from Bangladesh or Venezuela, and the welfare that we give them is way bigger than any middle-class income that you can get in those countries. And therefore, let's not have immigration. I say, no, let's not have welfare.
Yes, finally, somebody gets it.
System, and then they won't come. Or let's privatize everything. Now, I agree that nobody's going to privatize anything, but I don't care about reality. I care about getting clear on what the libertarian theory is. Now, let me give you what I regard as my ace in a hole, which I regard as my, home run with three guys on, what is it, home run with three guys on base?
Oh, a base is fully loaded home run.
Right. There's another word for it. I can't think of it. Now, look, you people, ignorant savages
grand
that you
slam.
Are, grand slam, thanks. You people think that babies come from sexual intercourse? No! They come from this country called Storkovia. Babies are delivered by a stork. And they come from the country called Storkovia. That's where they come from. You ignorant people who think that it's sexual intercourse. No, you're a bunch of perverts. It's Storkovia. Now, if you really seriously, this is a reductio ad absurdum of the Rothbard Hoppe position.
Yeah.
If you really believe in no open borders, then people shouldn't be able to have babies without government permission. On the other hand, if you believe that you marry someone or you have a baby voluntarily, that that's a legitimate thing, that that's not violating the non-aggression principle, well, then you have to have open borders. Because, look, anything you can say about the billion Chinese, I can say about the billion new babies that are coming. In 18 years, they're going to vote badly. In 18 years, some of them will be criminals. In 18 years, they'll be on welfare or whatever. See the point I'm making? Namely, the only consistent libertarian position is open borders. Because if you don't believe in open borders, then you have to have control not only on immigrants, but immigrants from this country called Storkovia.
Mm.
Do you see the point?
I do, yeah.
So Now, the solution, again, is to just privatize every square inch, and then we won't be worried about being inundated by people that we're not comfortable having. So we can have our cake and eat it. We can have our libertarian principles, and we can also be protected from being overrun by alien people.
Yeah, the problem then becomes, which comes first, people being weaned off the morphine of welfare or their fear of the other, quote unquote, getting the best of them? And it seems like the fear of the other might win out on this one, at least in the United States.
Well, might win out is not a normative question. That's a positive question. Namely, it's a scientific question. It's a question of which will occur. Mm. We're not interested in what will occur. We're interested in rights. We're interested in justice. We're libertarians. We want to get clear on what the libertarian position is, what the proper libertarian position is. And the proper libertarian position is a should or a normative question. So we're not that interested, although we're not uninterested, but we're not that interested in what will happen. What we're interested in is what's righteous. And what's righteous is to not stop peaceable people because they're not violating the non-aggression principle. And if we're worried about being inundated, we have our vase, as the bad guys say. We can protect ourselves too. Privatize. Now, if they don't want to privatize, tough on them. If they don't want to get rid of welfare, let them be inundated by masses of people. We libertarians have to be clear on what libertarianism is. That's our primary goal. And the only proper goal is, the only proper analysis is open borders. Now, this thing about Murray Rothbard, where he said, well, Stalin put a bunch of people in, what was it, Latvia, Lithuania, places like Estonia, little countries.
Right.
Well, that's the government. If Lithuania were completely privatized, the owners of Lithuanian soil would say, well, you know, you can't come in. We hear you knocking, but you can't come in because you're a trespasser. We own all this property. So I think Murray was wrong. Look, Murray is not God. Murray is just Mr. Libertarian. Murray is the best libertarian who ever trod the earth. I revere Murray. But we're not a cult. We're not an Ayn Rand cult. I've disagreed with Murray while he was alive, and we were still friends. I've disagreed with him on several issues, voluntary slavery and abortion and several others. He was a very nice man. We're allowed to disagree with our leaders. Look, Ron Paul and Murray disagree on abortion. So we can't, what are we going to do when our two leaders disagree? We have to think for ourselves. And we don't want to have, ad hominem arguments or arguments from authority.
Right.
We don't want to say, well, since the authority said it, it must be right. We have to reason as best we can. And that's what I'm doing. I'm reasoning as best I can. And here I disagree with Murray and Hans. And I think Hans is one of the most creative libertarian theorists. His stuff with argument from argument is just
a priori argument. Wonderful.
Oh, the a priori of argument. I mean, Hans is magnificent libertarian and Murray Rothbard is Mr. Libertarian. And I think they're both wrong on this issue. Mm. And I think Murray is wrong on abortion, but that's a whole other issue. So that would be my attempt to have our cake and eat it, to cleave to libertarian theory and also to not be inundated by masses of people that we will change our culture and our way of life and all that.
Very good.
Thank you so much for clarifying this topic. Like, this is so sorely needed right now with all the misinformation, especially from prominent anarcho-capitalists out there. That was razor sharp, precisely clear, and everybody needs to hear that. So thank you so much for that.
I told Dan to say that. I gave him $10.
We're all in cahoots.
Right.
This is anarchy.
Right, right. So, we've created another rabbit hole right here, but I think that the professor did a fantastic job. We could do another episode on this to talk about this further, but we have to move on to the beautiful topic of the internet. Now, let's see here. Dave writes, in the new digital economy, internet access needs to be considered a utility. It's a service, not unlike electric he means electricity and water, where whoever gets their lines ran first now has a natural monopoly on the service area. The government should own the underground conduit that holds the wires and rents the space to providers. There is no current competition in the ISP market. Companies can overcharge and underdeliver services as they do nationwide.
Well, I disagree with this.
Surprise.
As you can imagine. I don't like the idea of having water or sewer or electric being utilities because that's socialism. Socialism is government ownership of the means of production. There's no reason. Look, I have a book on water. Let me show you the book. Where is it? Here it is. Water Capitalism.
Yes.
Yeah. And what it says is the case for privatizing oceans, rivers, lakes, and aquifers. I don't know if you can see it there. So I favor privatization of oceans, rivers, lakes, sewage, drinking water, everything.
Oh, Al Gore's heart just skipped a beat.
And certainly on electricity, I don't think that should be a utility. Look, a utility is communism. Yeah. We shouldn't have any utilities. You see, the problem with this is what I call the problem of long, thin things. Long, thin things are wires, telephone wires before the advent of modern telephones, and sewers and water and electrical wires and all that stuff. And you'd think that the government has to do that because, look, if we had a new housing development of 1,000 houses, and to get everyone to agree to have the XYZ sewer company in there, it'd be a dog's breakfast. It'd be horrible. So the way to solve this problem is it's a matter of timing. You see, let's say we are developing this, I don't know, 50 acres, and we're going to put 1,000 houses in there. And what we do is we sell the houses with all of these things put in, wires, electric, telephone, sewage, water, whatever. And not only wires, but even garbage collection. Because it's much better to have one garbage company go up and down this one street and pick up every garbage from every house,
right,
rather than have 15 of them. Some people call it a natural monopoly. I don't like curse words. Monopoly is a curse word. Namely, what I'll do, I'm developing this land, and I'll sell it to you with a contract with one sewage company, with one electric company, one water company, one telephone company, one electric company. And then I say, you 1,000 people, you got a 5-year contract with these 5 different companies. And after 5 years, you can change it by a majority vote. And if I do that, the land that I sell you will be very valuable. On the other hand, if I just sell you this land with no contracts for these long, thin things, it's worthless because you're going to get in there and you're saying, now how am I going to get electricity? How am I going to get sewage? I got to meet these other 999 idiots and I got to deal with them. The transactions cost will be phenomenal. So that's the solution. So I resist and I won't say resent, but I resist this idea that there any legitimacy of public utilities for those long, thin things.
Right.
And the solution is looking at what time are we doing it? Are we going to start up after 1,000 people have already moved in and now they're wondering where to get their electric? Well, then a government utility sort of makes sense. Is this the only way to do it with coercion? The government says, look, we're going to have a utility. It's going to be the Acme company. And they're going to give you electricity whether you like it or not. That would be the only feasible way to solve this horrendous problem of getting 1,000 people to agree to anything. Look, you know, when you go to dinner and a movie with 5 friends, it's hard to figure out which restaurant and which movie that you all 5 want. Imagine with 1,000 people as to which electric company or which sanitation company. So I don't like the idea of utilities at all. And now let's talk about the internet. The same thing. This is a phenomenon. I forget the name of it. It's a technical economic phenomenon. The idea is that my telephone is not worth much unless you're online so I can call you. It's called some sort of good, a community good or something like that.
Oh, yeah, community good, right, yeah. That you're gaining from, yeah, but not excludable good, that sort of thing, yeah.
That's public goods. This is sort of like a community good, but that's not the right word. Oh. But the point is, right now Google – is sort of like this. But lately what Google has been doing is been censoring right-wing and alt-right people. Well, then what's going to happen is some other company, Schmoogle, is going to come along and say, we don't censor anyone. Or Doodle or somebody else is going to come and say, well, look, Google is a left-wing group. We're going to be a right-wing group. Hmm. So Google is acting very in a very precarious way. They're undermining their own thing by not being a public good, so to speak, or something that everyone would adhere to.
Right, right. They're supposed to maintain neutrality, do no evil, as their motto was.
Right. So I think that they're making a mistake from their own selfish point of view, but that is from their commercial point of view. Now, they have ideology and they want to promote leftism. Okay, well, then some other company, I predict, will come in. And, you know, you don't need – see, this idea of monopoly, you don't really need many companies. All you need is free entry or legal entry. There was this case – I forget which muckraking book was. They had this railroad in California that was acting very very nastily. They would raise the rates after the farmers put in their crops, and they would tell them something and then change their mind. The question is, why didn't they fear some other railroad coming in? And the answer is, in order to get a railroad coming in, you have to get permission of the legislature, which has been bought by this railroad. Or take the case of the blacks in the back of the bus. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat. This is during the Jim Crow era. And the rule was black people had to ride in the back of the bus. So the question is, why didn't some other black person or white person or a green person, for all I care about the color, why didn't they set up another bus company and say, hey, blacks, you want to ride in the front of the bus? Come on in. Water's fine. And the answer is, in order to get a bus company, you had to get permission, a franchise, from the very people who were doing the Jim Crow in the first place, and they wouldn't let you do it. But that's not laissez-faire capitalism. So in other words, if you had free entry or non-regulated entry, they would never do this blacks in the back of the bus nonsense because some other company would come in. The railroad in California would never do that because they would fear some other railroad coming in. And that's the last thing they would want, is some other railroad company coming in. So it's the same with the internet. There's no difference in principle between long, thin things and sanitation collection and the internet or Google, which would be a case in point. If they act in an incorrigible way, a deplorable way, to use Hillary's word, they'll get competition as long as competition is legal. And so far it's legal, although if Obama had had his way and if Hillary had had her way, Google would not be allowed, no one would be allowed to compete with Google. But if people are allowed to compete with Google, there's no need for a utility. So I reject the idea of utility for anything. Utility is just government intervention, monopoly, capitalism, corporate state monopoly, crony capitalism, bad for libertarian.
Very good. Danny?
No, very well said. I don't have anything to add to that one.
Excellent. All right. Let's move on to the next one. And this is the wonderful topic of education, which has recently come up once again now that Ms. DeVos is taking the stage under Donald Trump's cabinet, very strong proponent of charter schools, vouchers, etc. Dylan writes in, also, there are extra economic considerations, such as whether the right to life includes the right to some level of basic health that complicate that a pure market approach. As for education, even if a free market could produce equilibrium prices, truancy is illegal for good reason. Children have a right to education, and families have a responsibility to provide that need. But some families wouldn't be able to afford the education for their children at any market price. Markets for products of such high cost, even at the most conceivably efficient point, would still price some people out. He goes on to say that this comment is not meant to be an endorsement of public healthcare or schooling, but simply to demonstrate further complexities. Perhaps some private charitable organizations would subsidize those who otherwise couldn't afford it, thus keeping the government out of them. He says that's a big if, and he goes on to say, but I think we have his point right there. So he makes a couple points. He says he thinks that education is a right. As libertarians, we understand that that clearly can't be the case. It sounds like a positive one, and necessarily we can't offer those sorts of things. And then he also makes a point about truancy. And for those of you who are not familiar with truancy, this is the illegality of children under a certain age to be absentee from school without parental or guardian permission. So let's say the state says the child domicile can't be absent for more than four times unexcused. If they're over that, then they might be fined. Perhaps the family's fined, et cetera. Of course, you know, the parents can provide these excuses all they want, but it's different from state to state. But this is what truancy is. It's absenteeism, unexcused absenteeism, and that is illegal in just about every state, I think. So, Professor, what would you say to our dear friend Dylan?
You're quite right. Libertarians don't have any truck with positive obligations. We are only into negative obligations. So what's a negative obligation or a negative right? Negative right is the right not to be murdered, not to be stolen from, not to be raped, not to be enslaved, not to be whatevered. What's a positive right? A positive right is right to food, clothing, shelter, education, whatever. Now, the way rights work is if I have a right, you have an obligation. So if I have a right not to be murdered, you have an obligation not to murder me. If I have a right not to be stolen from, you have an obligation not to steal from me. And we libertarians adhere to that, and we accept that. But if I have a right to education, you have an obligation to give it to me. Where did that come from? Why do you have an obligation to give me education or to give my child education? No, there are no positive rights. Positive rights are anathema to libertarianism. Okay, now with regard to education, the mainstream view on this, Milton Friedman's view, is education is a positive externality. What's a positive externality? A positive externality is if I'm educated, not only will I get a better job and will I have a better life and get a better spouse and a better this, but I'll also make your life better. I'll be a better voter. I'll be less likely to be a criminal. I'll be a better neighbor, things like that. So the benefit of me getting educated will spill over to you. And since it'll spill over to you, you have to pay for me.
Right.
It's only fair. Well, you know, the unions have the same thing. They say, look, we're bargaining for all the people, our members and our non-members, and therefore you don't have to be a union member. You just have to pay union dues because we're helping you. Well, the problem with all these externality arguments is, look, I just smiled at you. See? Smile. I made your life better. So I'm now going to charge you?
Sounds nonsense. Legit to me.
The point is, just because I do you a benefit doesn't mean you have a right to charge me. I mean, all of civilization is an external benefit. I mean, we benefit from Mozart, and we benefit from having a civilization, and we benefit from each other's company. And the idea that you have to pay for a benefit, no, the only thing you have to pay for is stuff that you agree to be paying for. You had to pay for that t-shirt. I can't help back to the t-shirt.
Keep the compliments going.
You have to pay for that t-shirt. You agree to pay for it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. So at this point, we had an unfortunate glitch, as you might say, in the recording software. And the rest of the conversation, which was approximately 8-9 minutes, was cut off. We were really wrapping up the point that Professor Block was making concerning education, how it is not, in fact, a good that we can justify having other people pay for, even if they receive benefits from it. In other words, even though education does have a splash effect that, of course, education makes society, civilization better. Willis Peterson said, education, the parents' education can benefit the child. Children of the parents are more likely to attend school. There's a tendency for knowledge gained by the parents during their school to be transmitted to their kids. Education makes a community a better place. And Professor Block states that there's a lot of things that you gain benefit from, like a smile. You feel good when somebody smiles at you. Do we charge for that sort of thing? No. Well, we have to have a contract in place before that transaction occurs. If not, then, you know, it's just an incidental thing. It's an externality that doesn't cost anybody anything, so nobody really complains. But we know that since it is a positive right, the idea of education being a right, we can't force people to do it. We can't obligate people to actually pay into someone else's education. To each his or her own. So if you want your children educated, you pay for it yourself. If you want to educate yourself, you pay for it yourself. You go online, etc., etc. So the professor does dispute the idea of A, the right of education, and also the fact that the economic splash effect, this particular externality, should actually be charged for. Danny, am I getting that right?
Yeah, you have the idea. Positive rights is just a form of soft slavery. But Professor Black did leave on a great point, and he said, well, what about people who can't afford it or can't afford food or water, all this stuff? And so next time we speak with him, which we will in the near future, we want to address the topic of poverty, which I'm sure is on the forefront of everybody's minds. You know, not everything needs to be a market transaction per se. But anyways, in wrapping up a conclusion of the conversation, the guy, as I said, you weren't disappointed, right? He's incredibly sharp. Brings a lot of specifics to the broad lamp, which we like to claim that, oh, the market's going to take care of it. Well, sometimes that's not a satisfactory answer, but this guy, I believe, and we really just scratched the surface, but he did quite a great job, in my opinion, and I can't wait to talk to him again.
Yes, yes, exactly. And we have a lot of other topics that we didn't cover, and he actually added a couple more that he wants to talk to us when we get there in terms of charity and poverty, which we've talked about in other episodes, but it would be fantastic to talk with him specifically about it. The sex market, particularly women under consenting age or men under consenting age, you know, how do we deal with the rights of children and how do we avoid the sort of exploitation that could occur in a free society in regards to children, and also the idea of scientific research, space exploration, sea exploration, a lot of other exciting topics that we'll have to address when he joins us again. And that will be sooner rather than later. I know that he was very enthusiastic about that. But all that being said, I truly hope that all of you enjoyed this episode. I enjoyed speaking with the professor about it. And as always, if you have some questions about what we were talking about, because like I said, this conversation was about breadth and not depth. There's a lot of places in which we can go from here. If you have questions about these topics, email us and we will actually bring it up to the professor next time we talk to him, or we'll dedicate another episode to it. There's already some episodes that I'm kind of got, you know, thinking on the back burner right now that we will suddenly push up to the front now that we have talked about these things. A lot of topics that deserve our explication. So write to us at flagshipfreedompodcast@gmail.com. flagshipfreedompodcast@gmail.com. Remember, Flagship Freedom is the podcast that places you on the front line of the war of ideas. Until the next battle, thanks for listening. So long.
Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
And that one desire is you. And I know nobody else ain't gonna do.